This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Now we start a conversation about the rules of war. Yesterday at Central Command in Doha, Qatar, a reporter asked Brigadier General Vincent Brooks if orders on the battlefield have changed in light of recent incidents at checkpoints throughout Iraq. Brooks said that self-defense is a principal priority and subordinate officers are in charge of determining what needs to be done at that level of the battlefield.
We have to rely on the good judgment of our subordinate commanders out there who read the battlefield as it is, not as we think it is down here at this headquarters. The realities of the battlefield are then measured, decisions are made, and where there are threats, commanders give orders for their subordinates to take action. We always maintain the inherent right of self-defense. And so orders like shoot on sight and those types of things may not seem appropriate at this level. They may be appropriate at a lower level, and we're not going to second-guess the work that's being done by our commanders down there.
To a civilian, it can seem baffling that something as inherently violent and chaotic as war can have rules. Yet, nations all around the world, including the United States and Iraq, have signed on to treaties that limit what field marshals and foot soldiers are allowed to do in the heat of battle. These laws are designed to protect civilians and even combatants from gratuitous violence and exploitation at the hands of their enemies. But how can the international community police an event where death and destruction is often the goal? And is it realistic to expect that forces unwilling to play by the rules during peacetime will be constrained by the rules of war? Joining us now to discuss these issues is Scott Silliman. He's Executive Director of the Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security at Duke University Law School, and he's with us from the studios of the campus there. And good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Also with us is Ken Anderson, a professor of international law at American University's Washington College of Law, and he's with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And we want to hear from you. Are U.S. forces unnecessarily endangering Iraqi civilians? What are the rules for handling prisoners of war? Should American fighters have to play by the rules if Iraqi soldiers ignore them? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK, our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. And Ken, first of all, what are the treaties and precedents that govern combat and the treatment of civilians during wartime?
Well, the basic treaties are the four Geneva Conventions of 1949 that were reformulated from earlier treaties after the Second World War. And then in addition, there's a thing called the 1907 Hague Regulations, which was an attempt to state the rules of conduct for forces in land warfare. Then there's various kinds of rules that are customary law. These treaties also constitute customary law as well that all combatants are required to follow. And then there are treaties that have been elaborated in later years, which the United States is not necessarily part of. So, for example, there is the 1977 Protocol 1, additional to the Geneva Conventions of 1949. Which attempts, in some regards, to really restate, update the 1907 Hague Regulations about how you have to conduct war on the battlefield. Now, the United States is not party to that.
And neither is Iraq.
And neither is Iraq, although the U.S. has indicated at various points in time that there are parts of the treaty that it considers to be customary international law and would regard as rules that it would follow.
And have been incorporated into Army doctrine.
Yes, but not all. I mean, one of the things that I think has to be understood here is that there has been an assumption, I think particularly by academics like myself and human rights groups and folks on the outside, to assume that the U.S. has signed on to more than it is actually thinks is customary in Protocol 1.
Scott, how do military planners and you know, people in the field of you know, soldiers, how do they incorporate these rules into what they do, their tactics and their strategy?
Neil, it actually begins with training environment, where all soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, every year since the mid-1970s, have been given mandatory briefings on the law of war, exactly what Ken was talking about, the Geneva Conventions, the Hague Regulations, the customary international law. And not only are those briefings given on a mandatory basis, but also lawyers work with commanders and soldiers in training environments, in urban warfare environments, to ensure that as much as possible, there are no surprises in conflict. And you actually get the articulation of some of these standards, Neil, in what we call rules of engagement. And sometimes they even come in a card form for young soldiers. So they can look and try to understand in advance what the rules are depending upon the situation that they may confront. But as the general was saying earlier, self-defense will always be and has been a fundamental principle of every rule of engagement.
Well, let's get down to the specifics then. Self-defense. I think you know, there was that incident where four American soldiers were killed by a car bomb at a checkpoint. A couple of days after that, there was an incident at a checkpoint in near Najaf, I think it was. An American soldier opened fire on what turned out to be a truck full of civilians that was racing towards a checkpoint. Didn't stop after at least one warning shot. Would the rules of war apply to that?
Well, they certainly would, and the whole question again is whether those soldiers, that soldier that fired the rifle into the van and killed the women and children, whether he reasonably perceived himself to be threatened, and I stress reasonably believed. If in fact he did, and then the self-defense aspect of the rules of engagement kick in. Under the facts as I understand them, Neil, even with the Washington Post reporter suggesting that maybe the warning shot came too late, I think that international law would look at the actions of that young soldier and say it's tragic that those folks died. Nonetheless, he acted reasonably. He certainly did not target civilians, which, as Ken will agree, is a fundamental principle of humanity and customary international law. It's embedded in all the treaties. You can only target combatants, and certainly that young soldier did not intentionally target civilians.
And just to, we get a comment from Ken, but just to point out, I don't think the Washington Post reported it, that it came too late. It reported that his commanding officer thought the warning shot came too late. But go ahead, Ken.
Well, I fundamentally agree with that analysis, and I think that it's a very hard thing for people to understand, because you look at the carnage afterwards, you look at the people killed, and you say, how could that not be a war crime? How could that not be an atrocity that somebody is at fault for? And yet the reality is that that if you are not targeting civilians directly, then the standard is a much more difficult standard to conclude that something is a war crime. You have to wind up saying that it was, in some sense, gross negligence and intentionally done, willfully and intentionally done. It's a criminal standard like other criminal standards.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the calls. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org, and we'll start with Stephen, who's with us from Berkeley, California.
Hi. You know, my feeling about this is that, you know, in war, mistakes and tragedies occur, unfortunately. And you know, from the American military perspective, it seems as clear as possible that we're not there to get civilians in harm's way. But, it's obvious that the Iraqi military is going out of its way to use civilians. So that's my comment.
Ken? I could respond, yeah. I mean, here's the problem. We've talked for a long time in the run-up to this conflict about this being an asymmetric conflict in the sense of high-tech and low-tech and the rest. But what, in fact, it's turning out to be is an asymmetrical conflict in the sense that you have one side which is, in fact, trying very hard, as Bill Arkin was saying earlier, to find ways to follow the rules, and you have another side which has discovered that if it systematically violates them and uses, in effect, its own civilians as a material resource of war, that that is, in fact, its most effective strategy. And we run a very big risk about a breakdown of the rules of war if we don't find a way to confront this kind of asymmetry.
Similar to Vietnam in some ways, I guess.
Similar to Vietnam in some ways, I guess. But just to Scott, let me ask you, is guerrilla warfare per se illegal?
Well, guerrilla warfare, if it in fact involves combatants, Neil, who actually dress in civilian garb, who don't carry their arms openly, who clearly use treacherous means, dressing as Red Cross workers and the like, that would clearly be in violation of international law, and those offenses could be prosecuted. On the other hand, when you're talking about just the tactics of, say, an Iraqi soldier who comes to a checkpoint in a car and demolishes himself and American soldiers with a suicide mechanism, I don't think that's a violation of the law of war. That's a tactic that we do not agree with, but it's certainly not a violation of the law of war. Let me make one other point, though, with regard to Steve's initial comment, that just because the Iraqis might go to unconventional tactics and either tactics that are totally in violation of international law, that does not give us license to do the same. The obligations under the conventions are unilateral. They run to each country, and they do not depend upon reciprocity.
Mm-hmm. Steve, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
If I could add something to that, Neil, that in talking with numbers of reporters over the course of the last few days, one of the misconceptions that I've heard consistently from the media in the last couple of days has been that since the Iraqis are moving to these kinds of illegal tactics and finding them in some sense to be successful, then the level of civilian collateral damage that is now occurring in the ground warfare must be the result of the fact that the U.S. is also lowering its standards. And I don't think that that's a correct perception at all. I think the problem is that when you have one side which is not playing by the rules, and particularly when it's doing it in a way to draw civilians into it, then even if the other side is playing by the rules as best it can, the level of collateral damage will go up anyway.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email.
Yeah, Neil.
Well, go ahead quickly.
Me, Neil.
Yeah.
I agree with that comment. I think what we're seeing, though, and it's triggered by the comments made by General Myers and Secretary Rumsfeld just a little bit ago in the Pentagon, is even though the United States is clearly applying international law, the law of war, as Ken says, civilian casualties are going to go up. But with regard to a siege of Baghdad, I think the United States is less concerned about the violation of the law of war on our part. It's more concerned about the perception, the worldwide perception, when it sees more and more civilian casualties that may be unfortunate, but nonetheless are happening before their eyes. So I think what we're seeing now is an evolution of the war plan to the extent that the United States is very, very sensitive to how the war fighting in Baghdad is going to be perceived by the rest of the world and particularly by the Muslim community.
Yeah, and we're perhaps seeing the beginnings of that now. Somebody turned off the lights in Baghdad. The United States say they didn't do it, and there has to be suspicion, I guess, that if U.S. didn't do it, then maybe the Iraqis did in the efforts to create what might be perceived as a humanitarian crisis. Obviously, we don't know the facts of that case, but those are going to be some of the items that are speculated against. Let me read this email from Mike Brondos in Centennial, Colorado. I am very concerned about the report this weekend in the Washington Post that the CIA and other operatives were targeting leading Ba'ath Party members with car bombs and snipers. If this is accurate, what is the legal and moral justification for that? I can only imagine the reaction of the American people if Iraqi intelligence officers were planting car bombs or shooting at Republican Party or government officials in this country. Scott?
Well, what we need to do, Neil, is define a lawful combatant. And clearly, Saddam Hussein, who has tactical control over his forces, is a lawful target. And whether we kill him with a sniper, whether we kill him with a cruise missile, it doesn't matter. It's clearly a lawful act in a state of armed conflict. When you get more towards a civilian position of leadership, when you get to a Republican Party member, as far as we're concerned, then it becomes much more problematic as far as the legality of that type of act. With the CIA, again, operating in that country, they're not a part of the armed force. So it's very troublesome, but I'm suspecting that if, in fact, there is targeting going on, the attempt is clearly to target those members of the senior Iraqi leadership force that are clearly combatants rather than non-combatants.
Mm-hmm. And it should add that it's a big mistake to wind up equating the meaning of Ba'ath Party with Republican or Democratic Party in this sense. These are the people that run this regime. The regime and the party are one.
We're talking with Ken Anderson of the American University School of Law and Scott Silliman at Duke University about the rules of war, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now let's go to Tom, who's on the line in Baltimore.
Hi, folks. My question involves the decision to use massive air power in cities, and I know we can quibble as to whether precision-guided weapons are and what percentage of them are guaranteed to go off course, but the fact that we have used air power in this volume and degree is that an area that is covered by the rules of war.
Obviously, some of these rules of war drawn up after World War II, where extensive bombing of cities happened. Ken?
Well, I guess I think that if we go back to the comments that Bill Arkin was making earlier, it would be probably not fair to characterize this thing as being anything. It just isn't anything like World War II or anything like that. That this is precision bombing. That, in fact, the best kind of fighting that we're able to do, in fact, is with these kind of precision weapons where they can go over the targets, they can make determinations about the questions of number of civilians that are going to be killed. And that's far preferable, in fact, to the ground fighting, as Bill said. So I don't think that it's actually a fair characterization to say that the amount of firepower that's been brought to bear somehow means that we are targeting the city or anything like that. I think that, in fact, we have brought it to bear with an extraordinary amount of precision.
Tom, thanks very much for the call.
Okay.
Here's an email question from Marty. Has there ever been a conflict where both sides played by the rules? Do you want to try that, Scott?
Well, I guess it's a question of your interpretation. I can't think of a time when the United States in conflict, whether we're talking about Vietnam, whether we're talking about the first Persian Gulf War, where we would say that the other side played completely by the rules. What we're dealing with in this particular conflict, Neil, I think is the use of as much of the media as both sides can marshal to persuade their respective constituents and the rest of the world that the Iraqis are the demons and the United States are the rightful, truthful individuals who are trying to liberate Iraq. And on the other hand, the Iraqis are clearly trying to demonize us. So we should expect, it should not have been assumed that the Iraqis would comply with the rule of law. We know from history, just 12 years ago, that there were flagrant violations, that there were the use of human shields, that there were the torture of our prisoners of war. And so I think that was, in fact, anticipated. But again, that does not lessen our responsibility to comply with the rule of law, because as a nation, we have continually touted ourselves as a nation under the rule of law.
Ken Anderson, though, let me ask you about Tariq Aziz's justification on ABC last Sunday. He said, a people fighting an invasion has the right to fight by all means to defend itself. When you fight an invader with whatever means are available to you, you are not a terrorist, you are a hero.
Well, he has a lot of company in history in that view, starting with Stalin, in the view that the civilians are simply another material resource when you are fighting for the survival of your regime. Now, of course, Aziz wants to conflate the regime with the Iraqi people, which I think is can't be done. But he also, to be fair, has some support from Churchill. I mean, when the Nazis were on the verge of invading Britain, and Churchill had no qualms whatsoever about saying that when they came that they would use poison gas on the beaches and that they would fight a truly scorched earth battle which would not spare the civilians at all. On the other hand, the regime in Baghdad is not Britain.
We are talking about the rules of war. We're going to have to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll take more of your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, join Ira Flatto on the next Science Friday for a look at the status of the smallpox vaccination program, plus an update on severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today, we're talking about the rules of combat, but first, joining us now from his room on the ninth floor of the Hotel Palestine in Baghdad is Cox Newspaper's reporter Craig Nelson. Craig, good of you to speak with us tonight.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. More to the point, what is going on in Baghdad? The lights are out, I understand.
Yes, as I look over the city, it is completely dark, except for a few lights that are powered by generators. Normally, this is a very vibrant city that stays awake late, and cars stream through the streets at night, but there are no lights whatsoever. And so it's a very, very eerie scene with the sky full of smoke from the oil fires that have been burning for many, many days now, and a city in darkness.
We're getting conflicting reports of what may be happening in the outskirts of the city. U.S. officers say they've begun an attack on Iraq's international airport, which is about 12 miles, from downtown. Were you able to find anything out about that?
Well, I was approaching the airport when the bomb was dropped on the terminal, and there was immediately a loud barrage of anti-aircraft fire from the Iraqis. Cars that were heading toward the airport reversed direction and sped back toward the center of the city. And what seems to have happened is that the Americans, having denied that they hit any power facility in Iraq, what seems to have happened is that Iraqi authorities have turned out the lights so that American artillery can't get their range on Iraqi targets in Baghdad.
If they turn out the power for the lights, doesn't that also affect water and hygiene?
Yes, it does, and people are very concerned about that here. We talked to the representative from CARE International here this afternoon, and she said she was extremely concerned about the availability of water to people, especially on the outskirts of Baghdad, where the pumps won't work without electricity. So if this goes on for any length of time, it could create a severe problem like the one that's reportedly occurring in Basra.
We heard wildly differing accounts of where U.S. forces might be. Obviously, Americans are reporting, including the reporters with them, that they're on the outskirts of Baghdad, at least in some places. And at the briefing today, the Iraqi officials say, oh, nonsense, they're not even 100 miles away.
Yes, that's right. Information Minister Mohammed Sahaf called it an illusion and said that the Iraqis were going to continue their war of attrition, and that as long as they were going to protract the war, and as long as they could do so, they were confident of winning. And tonight, Saddam Hussein was on Iraqi television, and he told the Iraqi people that to make a citadel of Baghdad and encourage them to fight to the end. So this is a government and a regime that's gearing up for what they really hope will be a battle for Baghdad, because they feel they can obviously neutralize the strengths of American military technology here in the streets of the city.
When you say Saddam Hussein was on TV, I assume this was another statement read on his behalf.
No, well, he wasn't. He was shown at a meeting with his defense minister and leaders of the ruling Ba'ath Party. There was no audio to the report, and there was no way to place the location. The statements that were ascribed to him were reported by the Iraqi television announcer.
Okay. Finally, I know it's very late there, but if you were able to talk to the people in Baghdad today, did they have any sense of what's impending?
It's a very odd scene, because people are more in the streets today and the last couple of days, actually, than they have been in 2 weeks since the war began. Vegetables from the south of the country are getting through. I talked to a man who was selling bananas from Somalia. So and people were quite happy to be getting hold of all this produce. So where life seems to have returned from normal for some people, all of a sudden here we are in darkness, and another reminder that everything is anything but normal.
Thanks very much. I know it's an eerie scene, and we're waiting for, I guess, whatever happens. This is an awkward way to put it, but good luck, Craig.
Thanks, Neil.
Craig Nelson of Cox Newspapers speaking with us from the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad. Well, let's return now to our conversation about the rules of war. With us are Ken Anderson, a professor of international law at American University's Washington College of Law. He's here in Studio 3A. And Scott Silliman of Duke University's Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security there at Duke University. And Scott, I understand before we went to the break, there was an analogy to Winston Churchill in World War II and about what tactics are legitimate for defending against an invader. And you had something, I hope, quick you wanted to say, because we want to get some questions.
Yeah, it will be
too
quick, Neil. I think there's great danger in reaching back to World War II and trying to draw an analogy, because what your listeners have to understand is the real evolution of the law of war and international humanitarian law was as a result of the horrendous abuses in World War II. So the Geneva Conventions of 49, all the substantial treaties came after World War II. And so there is a clear borderline between the civilian populace and innocent civilians and noncombatants. So Tariq Aziz's argument has no foundation in current international law.
Let's get back to the callers. Kathy's on the line with us from Boston, Massachusetts.
Hi. My question is, if one country either declares a war on another country or just invades it for whatever reason, do the rules of combat defined by the Geneva Convention apply only if that invaded country somehow agrees to be a combat, or do they apply even if they haven't sort of agreed to the combat, just for the obvious reason that it, regardless of what anyone might think about the legitimacy of this war, it seems like it might be unfair for one country to invade a second and then expect that invaded country to agree to rules of combat.
Ken?
Well, the answer is yes, that the rules of combat are essentially designed to be neutral as between the reasons why the parties might be fighting. And so the answer is that these rules are, at their core, aimed primarily at non-combatants. That includes civilians, but it would also include soldiers who are pushed out of combat by wounds or capture or something like that. So the rules are designed as humanitarian rules. They're not designed in any sense to address the question of the merits of why they're fighting.
Neil, it's interesting that the United States government, as a matter of our official policy, will in fact apply the rule of law in a law of war, regardless of how a conflict is characterized. And that's our official policy, and it has been for some time.
Kathy?
Great. Thank you very much.
Appreciate the call.
Bye.
Email question from Peter Wang in Vallejo, California. Everyone seems to agree that killing Saddam Hussein is a legal war aim. Still, the idea of assassinating leaders as a strategy makes me uncomfortable. To extend the logic, since George W. Bush is commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the United States, would he be a legal target for the Iraqis to kill? Ken?
Yes. He is the war leader. He is a legitimate target. The Pentagon is a completely legitimate target. One of the things that we tend to forget in this country is that although we in our minds tend to draw circles around parts of the map and say that is the place where the conflict is taking place, the United States and Washington, where we sit now in particular, is filled with all sorts of targets, a couple of them a mile or two from my house.
And a couple of them, not less than that, from this studio where we're sitting now. Let's go to another caller. Let's go to Paul, who's with us from Philadelphia.
Hi, Neil.
Yeah.
Thanks for covering this topic today.
Sure.
I had heard a report, I think, Sunday evening on NBC, where the reporter stated, this was after the suicide attack, and the reporter stated that the U.S. troops' rules of engagement had now changed, that they would fire a warning shot or ask approaching civilians to stop, and if that warning was not heeded, then they would fire upon them, and that would then include any civilian, including women and children. And I was rather shocked by that. Shocked and appalled that we would be allowing our troops to fire on women and children, and I guess my question is that the case? Is that actually stated in their rules of engagement?
Scott Silliman?
Well, it's interesting, Paul. I've not heard that is a part of the change rules of engagement. I would question whether it is. As a matter of fact, if you have any type of formal order from a commander on down to his troops to fire on women and children, in my opinion, that could constitute a war crime because it obviously violates the principle of targeting only non-combatants. Let me go back to something I said earlier in the hour, though. When you're dealing with a checkpoint situation, you've got to look at whether that soldier, in applying the rules of engagement and possibly invoking self-defense, reasonably considers himself to be in danger. And if, in fact, you have an Iraqi soldier who is, in fact, holding a woman in front of him and firing, then that soldier must take action, even though it might possibly result in the death of both individuals. The fundamental rule of law that has never changed is that collateral damage can never be totally outlawed, but a soldier may fire, an airplane may target, unless the collateral damage is excessive compared to the military advantage to be gained. Now, that's an imprecise calculus, but that's the rule of law, the test that is applied in all these situations.
Well, I thank you. I was kind of the report I heard kind of took me by surprise, and I haven't heard those rules stated quite that way since I heard that on Sunday night. So I was just wondering if that had in fact been reported elsewhere, or if anyone knew that those actual words had been used.
I'm not sure that I would think that they were as strict as that, in the sense that nobody is going to say you fire on the vehicle even if it contains women or children. That there is always a room for judgment on the part of the person on the ground to decide whether they think that that vehicle constitutes a threat as it speeds through the checkpoint and doesn't stop.
Paul, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Email question from Maria Schmidt in Park Falls, Wisconsin. What are the rules of war concerning the use of cluster bombs in military conflicts? Scott, you're chuckling.
Well, there. I'll take a shot at that, Neil. This is obviously very controversial. In Yugoslavia, in Kosovo, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, there was an investigation specifically on this point as far as whether the use of cluster bombs violated international law. It was determined that the investigation should not go forward. The United States clearly maintains that cluster bombs are not an indiscriminate weapon, which would be a violation of the law of war. I personally believe that's the case. But again, a lot of it depends on how you do your targeting. Actually, as Bill was talking about, Bill Arkin earlier, mm-hmm. if in fact you're using cluster bombs in a desolated area, not within an urban area, then obviously it's a careful and discriminate use of the target of that type of munition. On the other hand, if you're going to drop a cluster bomb right in the middle of a market in Baghdad simply because there's a AAA battery there, that would be indiscriminate and that would be a violation of the law.
All right.
There is one further question about cluster bombs, which is the question of the dud rate of the munitions that are left afterwards that don't explode and in effect turn into landmines.
An interesting question, but does not address their legality. Email, this from Denise. What's to stop Iraq from calling U.S. prisoners enemy combatants, since the USA attacked them preemptively and are therefore thought of as terrorists, just as we have done with members of the Taliban? Ken?
Well, the question of whether they're enemy combatants, whether they're POWs, whether they're not privileged combatants, does not depend in this law on the question of who attacked whom or whether there's any justification for it. The legality doesn't of the resort to force does not enter into it at all. So the question of who is a valid POW, who is not a valid POW, depends on the questions of how they fight. Did you carry your arms? Were you in uniform if you were part of the military? And those kinds of questions.
Get a last. We just got a couple of minutes left. Wanted to get Andy in, who's calling from Denver.
All right. Hi, how are you today?
Okay.
You guys mentioned earlier in the program a 1977 agreement that seemed to be a furthering of some of the international rules of conflict, and I was just curious as to why the United States was not interested in signing on with that agreement.
Scott Silliman, what was in that protocol that the United States did not agree to?
Two particular parts of the agreement, Neil. One was it, in fact, loosened the standard of what would be a lawful combatant that Ken was just talking about. It allowed for individuals not necessarily to carry arms openly all the time, but only when they were in combat operations. It loosened the requirements as far as uniform. The United States didn't want to dilute or water down the fundamental provisions of Article 4 of the original Geneva Conventions. The other aspect of the additional Protocol 1 that was troubling to the United States was the attempt to designate a specific list of what would be lawful targets. The United States' position is it's more flexible, particularly with regard to dual-use targets, television stations, etc. So, as Ken alluded to earlier, the United States does acknowledge that much of Additional Protocol 1 has become and is customary international law, but certainly not all of it.
Mm-hmm. Andy, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And I want to thank both of our guests. We just heard from Scott Silliman, the Executive Director of the Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security at Duke University Law School. He was with us from the studios on the campus there. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
And Ken Anderson, a professor of international law at American University's Washington College of Law, and he was with us here in Studio 3A. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.